You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and please do follow this podcast on your platform of choice, including YouTube, where you'll also find loads of additional shorter video interviews and news insights. You can also subscribe and listen at www.thefreightbuyersclub.com. I will keep my guest intro simple today, as he hardly needs introducing. Many would argue he's the foremost container shipping and supply chain analyst out there. But I'll give you a clue if that's not enough. We're speaking on what he, in his fantastic regular news commentaries on LinkedIn, would no doubt call day 235 of the Red Sea crisis. He's the director and partner of Line Again, which provides education and training services to the liner shipping industry. And with his consultancy and analyst hat on, he's CEO of Vespucci Maritime. Lars Jensen, welcome to the Freight Buyers Club.
Thanks for having me.
Lars, your updates from the start of the Red Sea crisis, they've been immensely popular. Was there something about this particular crisis that prompted you to commit to these mostly daily updates? Because I'm sure it's quite time consuming. And I guess a couple follow-ups on that as well. I mean, have you been surprised how popular they've been? And if all this continues, how long are you going to continue putting all your time and effort into it?
You can say I was doing this already prior to the Red Sea crisis. It was just not necessarily daily. It fluctuated. Sometimes it was basically daily. Sometimes it might just have been one or twice per week. When the Red Sea crisis first broke, there was clearly something new every day. And then that's just sort of figured, well, that's a nice structure. It's a nice frame. So the intention for now is definitely to keep it updated.
So you could be doing this 5 years from now then, I suppose.
Well, unless the industry gets boring and I find something else to do, because quite honestly, I also do this out of the sheer interest I have for this industry. I find it fascinating. I'd like keeping up to speed with what's going on.
And I know you do a lot of other interesting things, which I'll come back to later on. But let's stick with the Red Sea. When we look back at the pandemic and the ever-given blockage of the Suez Canal for the best part of a week, was all that a forerunner or maybe a trial for how carriers and supply chains have been able to adapt to this new shock this year? Or do you think the demand side of the picture makes those comparisons a bit of a stretch? Obviously, I'm saying that as we're talking in August when global stock markets are tumbling, fears of a US recession are growing, that demand side has sort of changed slightly in the last few months.
Yeah, I would rather say, I wouldn't say that the pandemic was a practice run for what we're seeing now. I would rather say the dynamics unfolding now are almost a carbon copy of the dynamics under the pandemic, which means that the lessons learned in right now, especially from the carrier side, are applied again. And that means that the developments and the speed with which changes happen are, of course, also faster this time around because the lessons have already been learned.
On a general level, how do you think lines have performed this year or performed during this particular crisis operationally? Obviously, financially, they've done quite well, but or maybe in terms of their willingness to honour contracts with shippers this time around as opposed to during the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So when freight rates suddenly go up by a factor of five, if you're seeing it from the carrier perspective, they have done immensely well. If you're sitting on a freight buyer's side, this is absolutely horrendous. So that one aside, right, there are two ways to it. But it's very clear that obviously when it comes to freight rates, the carriers have learned their lessons from the pandemic. They have learned they can increase rates further and faster than we ever thought before. And they're doing that again. What is also clear is just how fast they were at rejigging their networks. I mean, keep in mind, from one day to the next, we have to go around Africa. The Suez Canal was no longer an option. That is an enormous task. Yet, within a few weeks, all the ships had been redirected. I would say within 5 to 6 weeks, the new networks had actually stabilized. That is a phenomenally fast turnaround in trying to stabilize supply chains under conditions that are actually outside the hand of the carriers. The last thing I would say, and I think this is sometimes a bit overlooked, Think back to November 23, just before the Red Sea crisis. I mean, maybe exaggerating slightly here, but to some degree, everybody was laughing at the carriers. They made a lot of money during the pandemic. Then they overordered. They got far too many ships. Freight rate crashed, and they were becoming loss-making in Q4. That seemed to be history repeating itself. Had it not been for that overordering, imagine where the market would be now. We have just enough capacity to go around Africa. Without overordering, we would be in a much, much worse condition today than we actually are.
So lines adapted super quick. That had this a trial period, I called it, but you know, COVID did provide some sort of, they were able to move very quickly this time around after that experience. I'll just put some numbers on that supply side element that you just raised there. In 2024, we've had 1.6 million TEU increase in container shipping capacity over the first half of the year or so. That's over 260 new ships, which BIMCO says is the fastest growth of the fleet in 15 years. Even so, we've got these networks still stretched. Lines are scurrying for long-term charters, placing new orders for ships. Is all of this the right strategy from a liner point of view? Because there's a huge, huge, huge risk that if we did have peace in the Middle East, that we would have the biggest crash in history, wouldn't we?
No, I mean, reality is, I mean, this was also all the models I had. Again, let's look at end November 2023, that we would be in the bottom of a down cycle here in 2024. Had it not been for the Red Sea, the conversation you and I would have been having right now would be around extremely low freight rates, and it would be around carriers that would be idling vessels and laying them up in fjords here and there because they would have too many vessels.
Okay, let's look at it a different way around then. So even with all of these extra ships that we've had, capacity is still quite stretched. Those networks are still pretty stretched. We see this in lots of different ways, which I'll come to shortly. But is there any scope for the sector to cope with any additional shocks?
No, absolutely not. If you measure global demand, not the way we usually do just in TEUs moved, but if you move in TEU miles and take that into account, compared to last year, demand is up between 25 and 30%. That is an astonishing demand growth. And that's, of course, because we now have to go around. So even though we had a massive injection of new vessels, it's just enough to also cope with this, which also in a very real sense means there is no scope to deal with any other calamities on top.
At least one liner executive has talked the market down. Well, I don't know if down's the right word, but it suggested that despite diversions around Southern Africa, there could still be overcapacity. Is that likely? Is that possible? In fact, do you think carriers would even let that happen? They've got plenty of options. They could slow services down. They've got ways of tightening up that supply-demand balance, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly. The challenge here is we have enough just to go around Africa, but some of those vessels are actually going faster than what you would normally see. So in the absence of any other calamities, what you would begin to gradually see is as we get more vessels delivered, they'll be phased in, especially on Asia-Europe, and slowing some of these vessels down that are actually going relatively fast. Slowing those ones down would save operational costs. And one thing that nobody seems to talk about, going around Africa and going faster around Africa has massively increased the carbon footprint, the transportation sector. Slowing some of these down by injecting more vessels will at least alleviate part of that problem.
So there's always a positive. What does all this mean for shippers, based on what you've just been saying there? They should be preparing for longer-term higher spot and contract rates, even though they're already up, they're at pandemic levels, although short of some of those highest peaks.
Yes and no. I mean, what we're seeing unfold right now, over the last few weeks, you have seen the spot rates on some of the key deep-sea trades. They have flattened out and are beginning to decline slowly. And I think that's very much in line with a market where we had the peak season start a lot earlier than usual, which would also imply that we're coming up to the end of the peak season earlier, right around now. So again, barring any other calamities, then later on we might talk about what those might be, because there are some calamities on the horizon. But barring any calamities, we are past the peak of the market. That doesn't mean rates are going to plummet rapidly, but you're going to see a slow abatement of rates, at least until we get to the Chinese holidays in the beginning of October.
So a new higher plateau through Q4 or the end of the what would have been the peak season?
No, it's going to abate slightly until you get to the Chinese holidays in October. Then usually you have more of a seasonal drop in rates, which you would also expect to happen this time around. Except the beginning of October with Chinese holidays also coincide with, I wouldn't call it holiday, but potentially US port workers on the East Coast going home and not working.
Right, I'll come back to the US East Coast workers, but then looking a bit further forward then, so we'll have you're saying we'll probably look at a slight softening of the market in Q4, and then we'll be another build up through to Chinese New Year.
Yeah, we will have the usual build up to Chinese New Year. But the thing to also keep in mind is, let's assume, and that might turn out to be reality too, that we're still not going through the Suez Canal. Even when we get into 2025, the issue in the Red Sea might persist. But that means 2025 is not going to be as tight as now. So once we get to peak season 2025, we are not going to see rates go up to the highs we are at now. Because between now and peak season 25, we will still have a lot of additional vessels that are being delivered. So the baseline expectation shippers should have is we are coming out of the worst of it. So barring any calamities, this was the worst. Rates will abate and go down. They'll, of course, go up again next year in peak season, but not to the highs we have seen here in summer 24. But they're also not going to collapse back down to the extremely low levels that we saw towards the end of 2023.
Does that scenario that you've just outlined there, does that mean we might see a little bit less congestion at port if those networks become a bit more efficient? Or is this just one of the necessary symptoms of the fact that we have got so many more ships turning up at gateway ports, they need to transship more, or they need to emit calls to try and maintain some sort of schedule integrity? Obviously, a lot of this has occurred in Asia or it's in the Med.
Yeah, the issue is some of the port congestion you're seeing, especially in Asia, a lot of that is a ripple effect of the Red Sea crisis. As long as we don't solve the Red Sea crisis, it will be hard to materially solve the congestion problems that we see in Asia.
I'll come back to some of the more near-term shocks that we might see slightly later on, but just kind of a bit of a wider perspective on this with your deep experience. Is this targeting of the Suez Canal for apparently political ends, do you see that as a unique event, or do you see maybe the actions of the Houthis and their supporters as presaging perhaps a new stage of geopolitical relations where global trade is seen as a legitimate target, and the event of 2024 highlight how vulnerable long-distance supply chains are, given the low cost and long range of a new class of relatively affordable weapons such as drones and missiles that are very difficult and expensive to defend against for navies?
Yeah, the challenge I see is, I think probably even the Houthis have been surprised as to how successful their campaign has been, at least successful in the sense of seriously disrupting and interfering with the global supply lines. And this has indeed shown other actors around the world how cheap and effective a tool this can be. So I would not think that the Red Sea is going to be a standalone issue. We are likely going to see more of this used either by non-state actors or by state actors when they want to press home a point somewhere. We've got plenty of choke points around the world where, unfortunately, such tools can be used.
Where do you see the most risk?
The one highest at risk is the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, as long as we still have Iran behind the Houthis, we are seeing escalations between Iran and Israel. There, I would point to the Strait of Hormuz as being the most likely next flashpoint. That will have less ramifications on container shipping. It will have some. Let me get back to that in a second. But obviously, it will be a lot more important for oil tankers, of which I'm not an expert. But from a container shipping perspective, if the Strait of Hormuz gets impacted, there are two key issues to watch there. One is, especially Jebel Ali is an enormously large gateway hub also for Indian cargo. So interference in the Strait of Hormuz will have massive repercussions on India as well. And it would basically box in Saudi Arabia. They are already halfway boxed in with cargo into the Red Sea. Having challenges in the Strait of Hormuz would put the Saudis in an extremely uncomfortable position.
When we last spoke, I was quite taken with your vision of an emerging sort of regionalization, but particularly the potential of a new Indian Ocean Rim powerhouse regional economy. Is that all at threat from what's happened over the last 6, 7, 8 months?
Actually, I would say quite the opposite, because what we've been seeing over the last 6 months, now in the absence of the major carriers, they cannot go Asia into the Red Sea, at least not at any kind of scale. This has awarded enormous opportunities for a lot of regional shipping lines based in Dubai, in Saudi, in India, in Oman. You've got a lot of regional players there that have been able to expand their operations much more rapidly than they otherwise would have. They're tapping into a cargo base they otherwise didn't have access to, and they're becoming enormously profitable doing that. So the longer this crisis lasts, the more solid a foothold you will give to a lot of these regional carriers, which they can then use to expand beyond just servicing the Red Sea during the crisis.
What does that mean for the top 10 carriers then? Does that mean that they've been buying the wrong ships and maybe the growth markets of the future are more regional?
No, I think this more goes down the line of that's also been my thought process for quite a while. We have been so accustomed to over the past many decades that the large global lines by nature are, well, global, and they can serve everywhere. In an increasingly unstable geopolitical world, especially one where you've got more confrontation between the large states, you're increasingly also getting into a world where it becomes more difficult to be a global carrier. You are increasingly forced, I was about to say, to choose. If you want to service country A, you might not be able to service country B without repercussions or vice versa. This is, of course, not new. We have had for many, many years. If you want to service North Korea, that is fine. You're going to have a hard time servicing any other country around the world. That's an easy choice, obviously. But going further into the future, you cannot rule out you might be in a situation where you want to service Taiwan or do you want to service China, as an example. That becomes a much more difficult choice to make. That doesn't mean we can't have a global supply chain. We can, but it will be a less seamless experience. You will have more players involved.
It's a very more complex world, which probably is a good time to bring in the US here. I mentioned earlier there's the stock market crash. That's global, but a lot of it's stemming from what's going on in the US economy. A couple of things. I'll come to the elections in a second, but how are you viewing the US economy or the overall demand side of the shipping equation?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the US development now, I mean, that is more gut feeling than a hard analysis. It seems that a bunch of investors just got spooked over next to nothing the last few days. We had an early peak season with a lot of cargo. When you look at U.S. consumer demand, some of the latest data doesn't show any kind of decline. It doesn't show a massive uptick, which again just supports that the uptick we saw in cargo was early positioning of cargo. That doesn't seem to be a massive case to be made for a sudden and sharp downturn.
We have these seismic elections coming up in November with Kamala Harris running against former President Trump. Can you think back to any election that has taken place that has sort of been so focused on international trade relations in terms of a lot of the debates that are happening, certainly at least since the Cold War? I struggle to think of one. I mean, there's a lot at stake here for global trade and that landscape that we all play on.
There is, but I mean, back when Trump ran for president the first time, that was also very much on an anti-China trade platform. And very shortly into his first term, that's when he started the U.S. trade war with China. And if we look at the play out of that trade war, of course, that trade war was continued under the Biden administration. So let's not kid ourselves. Both Republicans and Democrats are likely to increase the trade war. It's just a matter of magnitude. The impact of the trade war seen from a shipping perspective is almost neglectable, because what happened in reality was, sure, you saw less goods shipped from China to US, but then you saw more goods shipped from Southeast Asia to US. And lo and behold, you saw a massive surge in Chinese goods going to Mexico. And in parallel with that, you saw Mexico import a lot of goods up to the US. So increasing the trade war, of course, it will have a negative impact in that imported goods in the US will become more expensive. That will put a dampener on demand. But apart from that, it's merely shifting the geography of the demand. It still needs to be moved on the ships.
So even if we have what's been threatened, which roughly is 60% tariffs on imports from China into the US and 10% on imports from anywhere else under a Trump administration, even with those sort of seismic threats, and I'll throw in also, there has also been talk of, if that cargo is diverted to places like Mexico, that will also be a focus of potential tariffs. I mean, this could carry on and carry on. And then no doubt there'll be retaliation from every country that's hit with tariffs. So you still think the shipping will just find a way?
Shipping will find a way. I mean, you might have a negative impact on demand into the US. I mean, if you put a 10% tariff of everything, you have a 10% inflation effect. And that means people have less money to spend. It's as simple as that. But apart from that effect, shipping will find a way, and it is an illusion to think that these tariffs will magically mean all production moves back to the US. There's absolutely no historical precedent or any data supporting that. It just moves to other low-cost production areas.
We always talk about nearshoring. We talk about China plus one. This idea that cargo finds a way to avoid tariffs, or companies do, that's really what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about, at the end of the day, it is phenomenally simple. It's simply about, where can I produce the goods at the lowest possible cost? And lowest cost, that is not just the production cost, it's also including supply chain costs and including whatever tariffs you might be subjected to. And most of the time, especially ocean shipping, given the overall cost picture, is almost free of charge, especially for high-value commodity items being imported into both Europe and North America. Then you have festive moments for the carriers, where freight rates are high, like we see right now. Even in the cases like now, you still have a lot of commodities where the freight rate is still low compared to all the other costs. If you are importing something that is small and valuable, it doesn't really matter that much if you have to pay a few thousand dollars more. If you are importing goods that are bulky and cheap, yes, then you have a problem. Then this matters a lot. So all shippers are not cut from the same cloth here.
We'll just take a short break. We'll be back with you in a second.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for Trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
We talked about, well, whether the global shipping supply chain can cope with future shocks and what those shocks might be. Now, please add any more that you can think of that I'm not going to throw at you. But the big one for me is what we talked about briefly earlier. It's the strikes by ILA longshoremen at US East and Gulf Coast ports, which are looking ever more likely on 1st of October. The existing contract with employers ends on September the 30th. That would be a pretty devastating blow to supply chains, but also probably a pretty devastating blow potentially to democratic hopes of winning the presidency again, I guess. No one wants this on their watch, do they?
The issue is, if you think back to the pandemic, when we ended up with these phenomenally high record rates, that took place in two stages. Stage number one was the pandemic and the immediate ripples. That led to rate levels that are more or less matching what we have today. Then you had a period in early spring 2021 where rates were slowly going down, as we are beginning to see now. Then in spring 21, you had the Ever Given vessel that got stuck in the Suez Canal. That was a trigger event for rates to double and get up to those extreme highs. If we get a strike on the US East Coast, it will have the same effect. It will be a similar trigger event. We haven't had a strike on the US East Coast since, I think it's 1977. So we don't have a lot to compare to there, but we can compare to what we've seen on the US West Coast. 2015, we didn't have an all-out strike, but we had go slow actions, and then we had individual terminals shut down for a day here, a day there. And very rapidly, that led to a massive buildup. I think you had a pile of 40 mega vessels at one point lying outside Los Angeles. That was not with an all-out strike. That was just with a small strike here and there. Should this happen on the US East Coast, keep in mind, we have zero excess capacity in the world. So this would have the same effect as the blockage of the Suez Canal in 21. And shippers should prepare themselves for, if we get a widespread strike on the US East Coast, plan for rates to go to the same extreme records as we saw during the worst of the pandemic.
So total carnage.
Yes.
Do you think there's to a degree there's been a bit of front loading just to avoid this? Has that been the driver of any of those early shipments?
Yeah, I think that is a significant driver in the US. In the US, it has been concerns over that we might have these kinds of disruptions. Whereas in Europe, it has more been driven by, well, you just have a much longer sailing time because we have to go around Africa. For the US, that's only a tiny part of the market that now goes around Africa that used to go through Suez to the US East Coast.
What sort of ripple effects could it have away from that, say, Asia-US East Coast trade or trades into the US East Coast? Because as you say, it's everything stretched.
I mean, if you have a strike on the U.S. East Coast, that impacts all services. So it's also the Atlantic services that comes from Europe. It's the Latin American services that comes from South America and Caribbean. For U.S. importers, all of a sudden, well, if that's the case, you will see people try to divert cargo either through Mexican or U.S. West Coast ports, which would then inevitably also lead to congestion in those places.
And maybe you'll get some container lines plunging in like we saw into the U.S. West Coast, hoping to get hold of some of those high rates.
Exactly. And you're going to see vessels diverted. Vessels that were en route to the U.S. East Coast might get diverted and say, fine, we're going to go to, say, Mexico. We might even divert them and go to U.S. West Coast if this seems to be a gigantic nightmare. So once a strike is then done, you're going to see several weeks of a cleanup process to get the ships back to their normal rotations.
Is there any advice you would give shippers looking at, ahead at sort of that Q4 and going, okay, we might have these strikes on the U.S. East Coast, but we could have a whole new tariff regime being announced, maybe not implemented then, but announced then. Even if it was coming into effect like 4 or 5 months later, you would still need to start acting almost immediately. Should they be preparing now?
And they probably are. I mean, that might also be part of what you saw with the surge. Not that much, though, because it again depends on who wins the presidential election. I can certainly see a scenario, if it's a Trump administration, it's just going to be a tariff on anything from anywhere. And that would prompt a lot of front loading. But I don't think it would be that severe if you get a Democratic president elected instead.
Just pivoting slightly, I think this ties in with the idea that there's bipartisan support for a harder stance on trade and on many other things with China from amongst US politicians. How do you view where the Federal Maritime Commission fits into this? There's been, they've got beefed up enforcement powers. They're setting new rules on things like detention and demurrage, threatening to watch government controlled carriers more closely. Then there's amongst politicians more generally, there's talk in the US that the Shanghai Shipping Exchange is being manipulated by China to favor exporters. Is any of this positive for global shipping or for shippers?
I see this in a slightly different light. There was a strong bipartisan push during the pandemic to blame what they tended to call foreign carriers for a lot of the economic maladies in the US. It's a view I don't agree with. There were periods when the freight rates were at their absolutely extreme highs, where there was a tendency to blame container lines for a large part of the inflation. If you look at the underlying numbers, that is quite patently untrue, but it made for an interesting narrative in US politics where you could blame inflation on foreign powers outside. And that, of course, leads to political pressure. Then we need more oversight of these foreign carriers. I'm not saying that a revision of the Ocean Shipping Reform Act was not in order. I'm sure there are corners that could be in order. If you look at detention and demurrage in the US, I think the technical term would be, yes, it is a mess. It is difficult to pinpoint who is responsible for what. Now they've got new rules. Let's see how they play out. I'm not sure the new rules will solve the problem. It will just change the nature of the blame game. Let's put it that way.
Are things like how we view container rates and the quality of that data, is that a new battleground politically almost, particularly relating back to that attack on the Shanghai Shipping Exchange, but more generally?
No, I think a lot of that is just done for political expediency. A lot of the, let's call them political attacks on the supply chains and on the container shipping lines often seem driven by an incomplete understanding of how shipping actually works.
Okay, there's another big change in global shipping coming in the next sort of 6 months or so. At the start of next year, Hapag-Lloyd and Maersk form the Gemini Cooperation. What do you make of that strategy? That the Gemini partners have promised massive improvements in reliability. Is this remotely possible given the current state of the market and the many symptoms such as port congestion that could impede their efforts?
That's really two questions. Is it possible, and is it possible under the current conditions? So let's just take 5 steps back. And when they first announced Gemini and say we're going to come up with these networks, it's clearly under the assumption that the market is normal and we don't have the Red Sea crisis. The reliability they promise, they're promising 90% reliability, sounds like a fever dream when you compare to the last 4 years. But let's not be jaded by the last 4 years. If you go back to the period before the pandemic, now clearly Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd were not collaborating together, but you had cases where 2M, so that would be Maersk and MSC, were operating Asia-North Europe services between 85% and 95% reliability. you had a stretch of, I think it was 4 or 5 months, where they had Asia Med services at more than 95%. That doesn't mean they had that level everywhere, but it goes to show that it is possible. We have seen it in the past, performance levels up around that level. So I wouldn't say it would be out of the realm of the possible for them to actually operate at that level of reliability under normal market circumstances. Coming into 2025, the question is then, will the market be normal? And the answer seems to increasingly be no. It's hard to see a short-term resolution to the Red Sea crisis. If we still have to go around Africa, reliability is actually going to be the least of the Gemini cooperation's problems. The more acute problem is going to be this very nice network that they have designed and presented. Well, that assumes they can go through Suez. If they can't, they need a lot more ships, and they don't have enough ships to do that, so they would have to modify that network.
So the big announcement, all that fanfare around what, these are all the things that we're going to offer, this is how the network looks, it's all a pipe dream unless there's peace in the Middle East. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah. Now you're kind of implying that it was a pipe dream when it was launched. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that premise. That under the circumstances it was launched, I tend to believe that it makes operational sense. The problem is the long-lasting nature of the crisis in the Red Sea.
Are you expecting any more changes in the alliance setup in the coming months? MSC is obviously looking like it's going to go it alone. The alliance looks a little short of ships on some trades, for example, although, as we've discussed, so does everybody else, but they particularly look a little bit light. What else happens?
No, I mean, I think the really interesting one to watch also from a commercial perspective is going to be Ocean Alliance. Ocean Alliance is the only group of carriers that are not forced to come up with an entirely new network once we get into 2025. Even if the Red Sea crisis continues, the Ocean Alliance carriers don't have to change their network. And no matter how good you are operationally as a carrier, when you change your entire network and phase in and out, there will be inevitable hiccups, no matter how good you are. Which means February, March, April next year, Ocean Alliance is the only ones that can go out into the market and say, you want predictability? Use our network. We're not going to change anything. You say, at least that's a short-term commercial opportunity for the Ocean Alliance carriers.
Listen to that, shippers. They've had some advice from Lars Jensen. Lars, if we look back in a few years at the events we've just been discussing that have happened like the last 6, 7, 8 months, who do you think we will be going, do you know what? They were the big winners of that period in time. They came up smelling of roses. And who on the flip side do you think we'll be saying, God, they really lost out during all of that? They couldn't see what was happening, didn't see where the opportunities were. They came up smelling of something far worse than roses.
No, there's a lot of different players out there. I mean, it's becoming clear already now, and that's not just because of the crisis now, but MSC is definitely coming out as one of the large winners of the growth and consolidation game, not just over the last few years, but over the last many, many years. They're really in a league of their own, which is also why they can now go down a path of not even needing an alliance going forward and still have scale. I would think we're also going to look at especially some of these Asian niche carriers that are right now benefiting from being able to run services from Asia into the Red Sea as solidifying their grip on parts of the intra-Asian market. Again, let's put the Red Sea crisis aside, but especially the Indian Ocean Rim and Southeast Asia was poised to be the powerhouse, the growth engine of global trade for years to come, partly as a result of China Plus One strategies. This will help boost them in that market. The great battleground is going to be the intra-Asian market. And, well, the carriers that can run ships without being shot at right now are solidifying that grip down in the market there.
If you're a freight buyer, it seems, if you're a freight buyer and something that's desirable is stability, it seems like there's almost no chance of any sort of stability. If we don't have peace in the Middle East, we're going to have extended volatility and higher freight rates. And if we do, we're going to have a total market crash, which could lead to all sorts of disruption as well. Is that right?
That's basically right. The challenge is if you're a freight buyer and you want stability, you need to find a new job. Simple as that, because you're not going to get it. The challenge is the most likely scenarios ahead of us for the next 18 months are fairly extreme. The scenario that has the lowest likelihood is a stable scenario. I mean, either we're going to see increased crisis, continued high freight rates, high volatility, or we're going to see the Red Sea crisis resolved. But that means ships will go back to Suez. We will have overcapacity. And mind you, be careful here. If you think as a shipper and believe the moment the Suez routing reopens, freight rates will crash, think again. Because the first thing that will happen when it reopens is we're going to see a lot of ships take the shortcut up to Europe, overtaking the ones going around Africa. So the consequence of solving the Red Sea crisis will be massive port congestion in Europe, which of course would then impact all other services coming into Europe from Africa, from Latin America, from North America. And it's only when we work through that port congestion, then will you see market rates come down relatively rapidly.
A lot of excitement ahead. Just separate from the day job, in terms of seeking excitement, by my count, you've been to Greenland, Antarctica, you've been local boats down the Amazon last year, I think it was. This summer, you've been at taking iron ore trains through Western Africa. Is the chaotic state of the world and container shipping not enough excitement for you, Lars?
Apparently not. Apparently not. No, I just have an affinity for going to places most people don't go to for all sorts of reasons. I'm usually seeking out interesting experiences, and they very often come at the cost of very low levels of comfort.
Good for you. Good for you. I fully understand where you're coming from. Lars Jensen, CEO of Vespucci Maritime, thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Pleasure to be here.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.